I tried out a lot of different, I call them isms. After I left Judaism, I tried out Buddhism, Hinduism, atheism, Christianity, communism. And you know what happened to me? It's a little funny thing happened to me. I was like, the last thing I was, if you'd asked me when I was in college, when I left college, the year after I left college, if you asked me, so what, do you do any religion? I would have said Buddhism. But whenever I met a Buddhist, like from Japan or India, I would think, there's a real Buddhist. Somehow it felt like it was something different than my, you know, there's something about Judaism that attracted me, and I didn't know what it was. And I eventually went on my own and just explored. And I went to Israel, and it's a long story how I got there. It started actually in rural Mississippi, my journey to Israel. Maybe another day I'll tell you that story. But I ended up in Israel studying, and I discovered something unbelievable. Like Judaism has this incredible spiritual foundation that no one ever told me about. And I would hope that all the work that you're doing up here in the Maimonides program and in college has at least a balancing or counterbalancing down here, that you're able to balance it out. What I'd like to give you tonight is a little bit of that balancing as a foundation for what you're going to be doing here. In fact, I have three goals for tonight. And these goals are going to be, we hope, something you'll be able to recall later on your own, give you some tools. Number one, I'd like you to walk out of here with a definition. You know, a wise man once told me, if you want to be an intellectual, always ask for definitions. If you're sitting in a class in college or a class like this and you hear a word and the teacher uses a word that you don't understand, what does that mean? What do you mean by that? So I'd like you to be able to define, when you walk out of here tonight, this key word. Spiritual or spirituality. I'd like you to have a good, solid Jewish definition that you can work with. Number two, these are just small little goals. Number two, I'd like you to be able to define the purpose of life. How's that sound? Do that in a few minutes. And number three, I'd like you to walk out of here tonight with at least one practical tool to help you use this in order to start to achieve this. At least one, I think we'll get to one practical tool tonight. Practical tool. Okay, how's that sound? Does that work for you? So I want you to hold me accountable for it after about an hour. If we met these three goals, I think we can do it. An hour is usually a little less time than I usually take for this. Usually about an hour and a half, but we're going to condense and give you the Cliff's Note version, maybe. Okay. So I have a question. Does anybody have a good definition for spirituality? Do you consider yourself spiritual? Raise your hand if you consider yourself a spiritual person. That's more than half. Someone just raise your hand. Give me a reason why. And before you, just go ahead. Can I call on you?
Sure.
Tell us your name again.
Alan.
Alan, what's your reason why you call yourself a spiritual person?
Because I look for deeper meaning in things.
Uh-huh.
That aren't on the surface level.
Deeper meaning.
Yeah.
Okay. Someone else. Alan, call on someone else to give an answer.
I'm going to pick on one of my brothers. Stu.
Why do you consider yourself spiritual?
Because I believe that even though the people in my life have passed on, that they're still with me, I guess, in spirit.
How does that affect you?
I don't know. I guess it affects me in a good way.
Believe in spirits. How's that?
Sure.
Okay, call on someone to give us another answer. What's your name?
Michael. There's the religious aspect of it where you have a belief in something higher than yourself.
They always have to bring religion into it, I don't understand.
Religion is the structural aspect, the structural basis for things. It's the way that spirituality is defined in a way that everyone can recognize. It may not be the same to everyone else.
What's your definition?
My definition? I don't really know how to define it. Is what it is to me. It's not what it is what it is to me isn't what it is to you.
How do you know you're a spiritual person?
Either that you believe that you are, or but I mean, no, you can't believe that you are, because there's, you can't just believe something without having a truth or a foundation to it. There has to be cause for belief. That doesn't work. That doesn't my worry. But I believe in God. Yeah. Well, sometimes you have to. There are instances where there is blind faith, but then the question is, when things happen that you can't explain, then what happens?
Michael, I'm gonna help you out a little bit.
Sorry.
I'll help you out. Raise your hand, everybody. Raise your hand if you believe that you have a soul. Oh, look at that. Well, let me be the first card-carrying rabbi to tell you that you are wrong. Shocking thing to hear a rabbi say, isn't it? You do not have a soul. And if anyone tries to tell you, sorry, you know, I shouldn't say too loud in this building, right? If anybody tries to tell you have a soul, tell them that they're wrong, they don't know what they're talking about. What does Judaism say? You don't have a soul. You are a soul! You have a body. And the fact that you could say, raise your hand and say you have a soul, shows you how confused you are. Now, I don't blame you. Our society's done it to you. Our society's messages, if you think about it, are constantly, you're a body, you're a body, you're a body. It's all we hear. And we internalize it. But Jewish wisdom says, you, in your nature, your essence is soul. Body is a temporary fusion that your soul is attached to a body, and that's part of who you are now, but it's only temporary. Very important distinction. And everything we do in Judaism is based on this fundamental understanding. And we're going to have to spend a little bit of time about talking about this to get it clear, and I'm sure you'll have some questions. But this is the first and foremost starting point that we have to start in Judaism, Jewish thought, that your nature essentially is soul. And therefore, I'm going to give you a definition of spirituality based on that. A Jewish definition, and it touches on what you all have said, and probably some other people have been thinking. But I'm going to help you clarify that. And in Jewish terms, spiritual means any experience that is primarily that of the aspect of myself that we call soul. It's a little bit circular, but you'll see where this is going. As opposed to that aspect of myself, which is temporary, which is called body, which, what's a word that we would have as opposed to spiritual for that?
Physical.
Physical. I like better material. Physical works, but you'll see why a little bit why. I think physical can be spiritual. And you'll see why. So I'm going to instead use the word material. But you could say physical as well. They're very similar ideas. So I'm saying spiritual as opposed to material. Okay? Someone had a question.
Yeah. How do you know that your soul, your essence, isn't just trained by society, like Foucault would say? Yeah, simply that you're structured by institutions.
We definitely are.
Okay.
I believe that entirely. That's why we need someone to tell us when we're off base. Now, your question is, where is the source of this knowledge? That's a question I'm not ready to answer right now. It's just a different... I'm happy to answer it next week.
Okay.
But let's get the fundamentals down and we can go. That's a really good question. Okay? What is the source of this information? I'm going to give you... what I want to do today is give you some definitions and give you some experience. And then another time we can explore that question. The experience I'm going to give you, which will help you understand this, is a, believe it or not, it's a meditation. Anyone ever done any meditation? Wow, a lot of people. Okay, this is a Jewish meditation. And you're going to think, gosh, what's a Jewish meditation? It's not necessarily so different than other kinds of meditation. Because human brains and minds work pretty much the same way, no matter what, you know, group you're part of, what religion or what ethnic group. So it's a universal thing, but the content is what's going to make it Jewish. And this content actually is quite secular in a way. Now, first, to do the meditative exercise, if you feel uncomfortable, that's okay. This might be the first time for some of you. I need to ask you to get into a meditative posture. I never tell them what to do. They always know intuitively how to do this. That means sitting upright, no slouching, shoulders back straight, relaxed. Come on, Rabbi Khan. You gotta do this too. Now, this is something, this is great. I wish someone had taught me this when I was in college. I only learned this after I was in college. This is a great exercise when you're feeling a little stressed with finals coming up or something, and a paper due. You can take 5 minutes out and do this, and you'll find it totally changes your perspective on your day. First, what you want to do is get into what scientists call an alpha state. Alpha state are certain kind of brain waves that are generated by training your mind to do this. And you can do this in just a couple minutes. I'm going to show you how to do it right now. To get into an alpha state, first, I have to ask you to close your eyes. And with your eyes closed, go ahead, close your eyes, pick up your right foot off the ground, and just turn it over around the ankle. I'm going to count 1, 2, 3 times and put it down. Now let's pick up our left foot and do the same thing. 1, 2, 3 times. This is just a relaxation technique. Now let's try your right hand. Make a fist, a nice tight fist with your right hand. Hold it. 2, 3, and relax. Now your left hand. Make a nice fist. Hold it. 2, 3, relax. Okay, let's try it with our head. Tilt your head down to the shoulder. Hold it down. No pain, just till it stops. And hold it 3 seconds. 2, 3, and then up, and then back to the other side. Down. 1, 2, 3, now back up, and with your eyes closed still, you're now probably in an alpha state, where you're just a state of relaxation. And now I'd like with your mind to remember something that happened to you in the past. And the thing I want you to remember is try to think of the most beautiful sunset you ever saw. Try to remember where you were. Maybe you were hiking, maybe you were on the beach somewhere. Remember that sunset. Remember who was with you that day, how the air felt. And remember how the sun was sinking slowly, this great big orb sinking into the horizon, and the sky is changing colors. There's reds, and there's oranges. There might have even been greens and violets. You're speechless. If you could utter any sound at all, it would be just wow. You can open your eyes. Did you find your sunset? What you just did right now was not merely a spiritual experience. What you just did was remember something that took you beyond a spiritual experience, what I call a transcendent experience. You really transcended, where you felt connected to something bigger than yourself. And I have a question for you. Why is it that it's once a year or once in a blue moon that we have these sunset experiences? Why not every day? Wouldn't that be awesome if you could tap into that every day? Whenever you wanted to throughout the day, have that wow experience? That is the essence of what Judaism is trying to teach us. Even through the Musar program, which you learned about in the first part of this evening, that's what I want to do in number two. Is in number three, and give you a practical tool to get there. How does it sound? You should walk out of your day with that tool. Okay. Any questions? Always, please, stop me. Ask me. Raise your hand. I like questions. If there's no questions, I'm wondering, are they awake? Are they asleep? Some people, I know college students learn how to sleep with your eyes open. So. You can never tell for sure. I know. So, anyone surprised that this stuff that I'm talking about this in a Jewish context? Is this foreign to anybody's experience? Is anybody here raised with any Jewish experience at all? No? Yeah, a little bit. What was your Jewish upraising?
My grandmother was Jewish, and she raised me because she was half Jewish, half Muntak, Native American. And it was unorthodox. She was a Kabbalah scholar, and she was very, very spiritual. My mom was Christian and thought that I had a demonic spirit following me, and my Nani was like, okay, we'll sort this out. And so she would read the Torah to her and all these things to quell the spirits or whatever.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people, see, that's a bit unusual. A lot of people associate Judaism with what goes on in the temple.
Oh.
Does that speak to anybody? That's Judaism, and that doesn't interest me so much because I went there, done that, right? What I'm talking about right now has nothing to do with the temple or the synagogue necessarily, right? It's a whole different thing. And people sometimes come to this class and they say, wait a second, what is this? Where does this come from? It actually is quite ancient. And a little bit of history. I'd like to give you about 2 minutes of history so you understand how deep and ancient this is. Anyone's ever been to Israel? Wow, that many people. Well, on birthright or something.
I lived in Israel.
You lived in Israel, wow. Okay, anyone who hasn't gone, want to go? We can help you do that. There are all kinds of trips now. I saw in the Hillel literature, they even have a birthright trip for Hillel. Well, you know, the land of Israel. Did you know the land of Israel in the first temple time period used to be full of meditation schools? I bet Rabbi Kahn didn't even know that. It used to be full of meditation schools. What? Meditation schools? What are you talking about? Yes, it did. It used to be full of meditation schools. We have evidence of this. And that most people were practicing it. In fact, I did this a little study on my own. I'm working on it. I didn't mention this. I'm working on a PhD right now in Jewish studies. And this is like a little pet project of mine. I did a little demographic study. According to the Talmud's estimate of the number of people involved and using demographic research and archaeology, the number of Jews participating, Israelites this time, participating in meditation schools in Israel was probably roughly the per capita equivalent number of college students in America today. Like, it was a major part of the society. It's really mind-blowing. Here's the problem, though. If you lived in Israel, do you know, I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you ever learn how to say meditation in modern Hebrew?
No. I was like 4 when I lived in Israel.
I forgive you. The word in modern Hebrew for meditation is meditatzia. It sounds yeah. What is that? What's going on there? So how does modern Hebrew come from? There's a guy named Ben Yehuda who wanted to revive the Hebrew language. You have to go, right?
Yeah. Sorry.
Okay. Hasta la vista.
Thanks. Yes. Hasta la vista.
This guy Ben Yehuda wanted to revive modern Hebrew, revive ancient Hebrew, make it a spoken language. One of the miracles of the land of Israel, that in 1948 we have a country again, and the language is Hebrew. The first time Jews have spoken Hebrew in 2,500 years. What did he do with new concepts and terms that did not exist in the Bible, like television and telephone? How do you say television in Hebrew?
I don't know.
Televisia. How do you say telephone?
Telephone.
That's pretty easy, right? He just sometimes he could find an equivalent and make up a word based on an ancient word, or he would borrow, if there was no ancient word, from English, because English was the language of Palestine then. So that, what does that tell you about meditation? If the modern Hebrew word is meditatzia, what does that tell you about ancient Hebrew?
There was no word for it.
There was no word for it. And if there's no word for it, that means?
It existed in a different kind of way, if at all.
If it exists, it must not have existed, or it must have been in a different way than we understand. Here's what I found out, something really remarkable. You heard of this myth before, that Eskimos have like 100 words for snow? It's actually not true. First of all, there's no such thing as an Eskimo. Second of all, those people who are called Eskimos who are not really Eskimos don't have 100, but I did find something about Laps. You know where Lapland is? Northern Scandinavia? They're like European Eskimos. I found a list of 49 Lap words for snow and ice. There's snow when it's fresh, and snow when it's 2 weeks old starts to smell. There's wet snow and dry snow. You think you know snow in Chicago? You don't know snow, okay? The Laps, they know snow. They have so many words for snow, right? And that whole list, and I put it in my book actually, and that whole list, there's not a single word for snow. I mean, just snow by itself. There's all these different kinds of snow, but they're not a general word for snow. What does that mean to you? I would think if you went into a Lap and said to the Lap, "Hey, how's the snow today?" They'd look at you like you're a little crazy. What kind of snow do you mean? We don't just have snow, you know? That's what I think is going on in ancient Hebrew. You know, it would be like in English if I went up to you and said, you know what I did this morning? I got up and I did some movements. You'd think I'm a little weird, right? And then you say, "Well, what kind of movements are you talking about?" Well, you know, I put on these special shoes I have and shorts, and I went out and moved my legs really fast. Oh, I get it, right? We have a general word, movement. We don't use it that way. We don't talk that way. We talk in the specific. I think that's what's going on here. Meditation, the lack of the word, does not indicate the lack of a concept. It's the opposite. It was so prevalent. It permeates everything in Jewish thought and Jewish practice, classical Jewish thought, that is, that you don't need a word, because it's in everything. Everything is meditative, ideally. That is really what's going on. That's a little history. By the way, when I say First Temple period, what am I talking about? Anyone have any clue at all? When you're at your next, DePaul mixer, and someone says to you, "So when was the First Temple anyway?" What are you going to say? You're going to feel a little bit embarrassed, right? You don't know your Jewish history.
3,000 years ago.
Sorry?
3,000 years ago.
Thousands of years ago, right? 3,000. Did I hear 4? Okay, let me give you a little Jewish history in a nutshell. If you here's a number. If you can remember this number, you'll remember all of Jewish history. Who's the first Jew?
Abraham.
by our general tradition. Abraham, right? So Abraham, or Avraham, his approximate date, I'm going to give you a ballpark date, is 1700. What is that? 17 what? BCE, right? Remember that date. If you can remember 17, that's not when he was born, that's not when he died, that's a year in the life of Abraham, okay? Add 400 years to that, about 1300, and you have the famous Moses, right? Remember the Ten Commandments, the whole thing? You saw the movie, right? Okay? Now, 400 years after Moses, approximately, King Solomon builds the first temple, okay? Anyone want to hazard a guess approximately how long the first temple stood? Come on.
200 years.
Oh, boy.
400 years.
400 years! Bing, 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 bing. Okay, about 500 is when the first temple is destroyed. Okay? You see this pattern, I hope. Okay? The second temple, anyone want to guess how long the second temple stood? 400 years. Now, these are not exact years. It actually wasn't. It's 410, 430, but I'm giving you ballparks. This will help you at the cocktail party, okay? Also, there was a gap between the two temples as well. There's a 7-year gap. So it turns out the second destruction, the sequel, was about 70 CE by those evil, villainous Romans, okay? But there was a 400-year lifespan of the Second Temple as well. And you know, this keeps going on and on and on. You know, 400 years after that, approximately, the Talmud is written. 400 years after that, the final Midrash is written. 400 years after that is Maimonides. It's really Maimonides, you know, fits in nicely. But I'm running out of room on the whiteboard, so you will pass out that chart later. But remember these dates. So when I or anybody talks to you about, gives you a book, for example, a reading from a text, you should ask, well, when is this from? When was this written? And help you place it on this map, 1700 onward, okay? So when I talk about the first temple, that's right here. This period is when all those meditation schools stood. They did not exist during the second temple, to the best of my knowledge. Questions? Comments? Okay, you ready to learn the real stuff? Okay, this is all introductory to give you a background. Let's now get into number two. Purpose of life. Are there any science majors? One? What's your major?
Medicine.
Okay, I'm safe. Whenever I have a physics major, then I'm getting a little trouble because what I'm about to tell you is heavily laden with amateur knowledge of physics. But you're welcome to check this out with your own experts. I believe the science is solid, although I don't claim to be a scientist. Okay, I did study science. I actually taught high school physics. That shows you how desperate they are in America these days for teachers. You've probably heard of something called the Big Bang, right? The Big Bang is the colloquial term for what scientists call the singularity or the origin of the cosmos. That's where what they believe. That's a standard belief now, and there's been evidence that it's happened, something called cosmic background radiation. There's lots of evidence the Big Bang happened. Not everybody's sure. It's still called a theory because no one actually witnessed it. Yeah. Now here's the problem. If you're a thinking person, you have to ask yourself the following question. If the universe had a beginning, as of course Judaism agrees it does, if you ever open up the Torah, you know that, what's the first line in the Torah?
In the beginning.
Right? In the beginning. If the universe had a beginning, as Judaism says, as science says, you have to ask yourself this question. What came before that? It's an obvious question to ask. The problem is science, by definition, cannot answer it. Because science, by definition, deals with what you can observe or measure. And according to the cosmologists, what began at the Big Bang exactly? Let's spell this out, okay? What began at this Big Bang? It was the start of what exactly? Don't tell me the universe. That's not a very meaningful word. Give me specifics. What began? What did not exist before this,
life,
and then started to exist after this, immediately after this? What did it say? There was no life necessarily immediately after this. I don't know that for sure. Yeah?
The elements as we know them. Like
elements like matter?
Right.
Okay, matter is a good one. What else besides matter?
Form.
What?
Form.
Form, okay. I suppose that, isn't that an aspect of matter?
Yeah.
Okay.
Relevant time.
Time? What else?
Space.
The three big ones. Those three things exist only, according to science, from this moment onward. How meaningful is it to talk about before there was time? From a scientific perspective, it is meaningless. There's no way you can go there. Science starts right here. In fact, what's the preliminary, perhaps the most famous journal of science today?
Science.
It's called Nature. It's all about what happens. I subscribe to Science. There's one called Science as well. But there's one called Nature, which is probably more elite, more expensive too. And Nature is all about anything that happens from here onward. Yeah? That's what Nature is all about. So, science doesn't go there. And you're a thinking person. You're asking yourself, yeah, what happened? What was there before the Big Bang? Well, guess what? Where science doesn't go, Judaism does. Judaism does postulate something before the Big Bang. And that something is actually interestingly logical. All this stuff, we can summarize with one word. Instead of making you guess it, I'm going to tell you the word. I'm be happy if you want to argue with me about it, but this is the word I think defines all these things. Finite. What does finite mean? What does the root mean? Anyone say Spanish or Latin or French or Italian or any words that... Yeah, what does fine mean or fin or...
End,
right? Finite means anything that has limits or ends, right? This stuff is finite, right? I can measure it. Matter is definitely finite. Most people agree with that. Space, people are confused about. They think it's infinite, but actually probably the most accepted theory of space is that it actually is finite, meaning if you went far enough in your rocket ship, you'd end up where you started. That's actually a predominant theory in astrophysics. Time, is time infinite? Well, is time finite in the sense of that it can be measured and that it had a beginning? Yes, it is finite. Will it have an end? We don't know. Okay, so I lump all these together in this term, finite, because by definition they're finite. But listen carefully. If all that began here was finite, if that's true, what came before that was what?
Infinite.
Not finite, right? You hear the logic? So anything before that must have been not finite or infinite. Now, if you're studying math, if you studied math in high school, you probably remember the number line. Remember it goes on like each direction forever? That's not what I'm talking about. That's infinity, but this is infinite with a capital I. What infinite means in Jewish thought is the sum of all possibilities, not just numbers. And there's a problem, because our brains are finite. And for a finite brain to think of something infinite, the mystics say, is like, try to reach out with your hand and grab my words as they come out of my mouth. It doesn't work, you know? So how do you talk about it? So we're going to spend a few minutes talking about this infinite a little bit and try to grasp it a little. We're going to dance around it. And you're going to see in about 3 or 4 minutes why that's crucial for understanding number two. If you want to understand the purpose of your life, why you are on this planet, you have to understand this. If you don't understand this, you're kind of like walking around with your eyes closed, according to Jewish thought. That's what I need to do for about 3 or 4 minutes. Okay? Questions? Okay. So let's talk about this infinite now. We've talked about finite enough. What is, if I told you the infinite is the sum of all possibilities, ways that an infinite something could be infinite. Remember, we're using our brain to think about it, so it's a little bit of a problem. But give me some ways that something infinite could be infinite. Infinite in what ways? Go ahead.
Why do we have to assume that everything that existed before Big Bang was infinite?
Because we see that everything after Big Bang is finite. The finite stuff was created, became into being at the Big Bang.
So is what's infinite from back then still around now?
Good question. I think we'll get to it in a few minutes. If I don't specifically answer that by 8:30, ask me again. Okay? I think it'll be answered as we talk. It's a really good question. Let's first try to understand what we're talking about. Then you'll see how it comes true. Yeah? Give me some ways something infinite could be infinite. We already really answered by putting the finite words down here. You know? Infinitely. When I say infinite, what do you think of?
Number.
Can't be measured.
Can't be measured in what way?
Anyway,
okay? So most people, when they think of infinite, they think of this. They think of something really, really big. In fact, I have this this meditation in my book on the stars. You ever go stargazing? You ever go out and look at the stars? Can you see them around here a little bit? You ever go out in the countryside where you can really see them? Why is it that the best stargazing is always in the winter when it's so cold out? That's what I want to know. It's, you know, the best stars you can see is because the Milky Way galaxy were turned the right way towards it in the winter. Anyone have any idea how many stars are out there?
Billions.
Billions, he says. Let me help you out on that a little bit.
Carl Sagan said billions and billions.
That's what McDonald said. Okay. Let's say, just for sake of discussion, you play basketball, some people? Let's pretend this is a basketball, right, about this size? If that was the Earth, if the Earth was about that size, now, is the Earth a big place or a small place?
Small.
You think of it as small, right? I do too, because you know you can fly around it so fast. You can look at it from a satellite. If that was the Earth, how thick should I draw the biosphere where all life exists? What would you guess? What did you say? About thickness of that red line? Any other guesses?
A little bit lower.
A little bit lower or more?
A little bit lower, but beneath it.
No, how thick should I draw it if I want to do a scale model?
Yeah, right about that.
About like this, where my fingers are?
No.
About thickness of the red line? Actually, the answer is about thickness of a sheet of paper.
Yeah.
Thickness of a sheet of paper, much thinner than this red line. About a 20th of that red line. What does that tell you? From our perspective, this planet is huge. We're tiny little nothings on the surface of this planet. We don't appreciate how big it is compared to us. But of course, if you look in relative to other things, it's obviously very small. How many Earths could you fit inside the sun?
1.3 million.
Oh, so you told me you didn't. I asked her if there's any science students, and you didn't raise your hand.
I just remember that from grade school.
Yeah, about a.
Don't I, the science guy?
more than a million Earths could fit inside the sun. That's incredible. The sun is huge, right? And of course, we know that the sun is not the only star, you know, in the sky. It's one of a collection of stars called the Milky Way. We call the Milky Way galaxy, and we think it looks like about this. Anyone know how many suns, or do you remember how many stars in the Milky Way galaxy? Estimated?
No.
No? No guesses? Wow, this is getting a lot out of this program. Right, you get a little history, a little science. Okay? Milky Way galaxy! Always write off, this is so much more dramatic, right? How many is this? 1, 2, 3, about 100 billion, give or take. Mathematic, scientific notation, that's, you count your zeros, so it's 10 to the 11th. Okay, that's one galaxy. Someone said there's billions and billions. 100 billion just in our galaxy. You know, the Hubble telescope in the early 90s, they looked at a soda straw wide field of vision at the sky, left the shutter open for about 3 days. It's called the deep field study. And many, many things that look like stars from a regular telescope are actually galaxies. And they extrapolate. You've got to see these pictures on the internet. They're unbelievable. Full of galaxies. And based on those studies, they've now concluded the number of galaxies in the universe. About 100 billion. Galaxies! So you want to figure out your estimate of the number of stars in the universe. You've got to multiply those together, and you got to add your exponents, right? But I'm going to write it out because it's so much more fun. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. Okay. Are we there yet? Are we having fun yet? That, according to our best science, is the number of stars in the universe. Is that a number that's meaningful to anybody here? Not to me. So to make this a little more meaningful for myself, I went to Google and I typed in grains of sand. And it turns out this is a common technique for teaching estimation to students. How many grains of sand are on all the beaches of the planet? What you do is you count how many are in a cubic inch, and then you extrapolate and you look at your almanac. How deep are the beaches and how wide and how many miles of beaches are there? And you come up with a number. And I found a bunch of different estimates. I found about 10 different sites that did this. Probably the most detailed was the University of Hawaii. And the range of estimates though I saw was from 10 to the 13th. By the way, if you multiply these together, what do you get?
25. 10 to
you add your exponents, right? So the range I saw for grains of sand was 10 to the 13th up to 10 to the 20th. Listen to that. Look at what that means. That means, according to our best science, there are more stars in the universe than all the grains of sand on every beach on this planet. Not just more, but anywhere from hundreds of times more to millions or billions of times more. Now, does the universe seem big to you? Is big a proper word? Huge? Humongous? Gigantic? And you haven't even started to scratch the surface of this concept. Infinite means beyond big. Big isn't even the right word. Okay, but we're using our finite brain to try to grasp some infants. We're dancing around a little bit. And I'll get your questions in a second.
No, you shouldn't even use big because something can be infinitely small.
Ah, that was my next point. That's a very good point. If you take a cubic inch of matter, right, how many atoms are in a typical cubic inch of matter? Whoa, atoms are really tiny, yeah? And guess what? They're not infinitely tiny. Infinite means you're absolute. What's your name?
Mike
is absolutely right. Infinite implies in every possible way, not just big, but also small. In fact, what I do is I put quotes around these because we're using human terms for something that is beyond our really ability to understand. Infinitely small. How about this? You know, I could put lots and lots of terms on the board for this, to try to put parameters around this infinite, but I'm going to have a problem. I'm going to have a problem with one term I'm going to put up there. It's going to make you stop. These are fine. You don't have any intellectual problem. This, I mean, it's hard to understand, but you can grasp the basic idea. But I'm going to put a term up here in a second that you should stop you and say, wait a second, that doesn't make sense on this list. What are we doing? Before I put it up there, what are we doing right now? We're trying to do what with this word?
Generality.
Trying to define it. What does it mean, define? Look at the root. Trying to give it limit. You're trying to limit, define something. It's a contradiction in terms. How can you define, give limit to something without limit? I'm not just saying that to be funny. There's a reason I'm saying that. You understand this. There's a term I'm going to put up here in this definition that should make you stop and say, wait a second, that doesn't make sense. Okay? The basic definition we're giving here is it has no limit or no lack. The term I'm going to put up here for this, one of these qualities, is this. And I want you to tell me why this is intellectually a problem. This is from this list. Why is it intellectually a problem for this no limit, whatever it is, to have this quality? If I have off you $100, will you raise your hand? Come on.
I guess there's a limit to how much you can give someone. Or
put yourself in the infinite shoes for a second, okay? You're the infinite, okay? You can be infinitely big, you can be infinitely small, you can be infinitely strange. Why can't you be infinitely giving? What?
Eventually, you give everything.
So? Why is that a problem?
That would, by definition, give it limit.
But then that thing wouldn't be infinite anymore.
Why?
Because it gave part of its infinity. And
you're saying interesting things, but you've missed a step. There's a step before what you just said. There's a problem before. Maybe that's a problem too. There's an even more fundamental problem.
If you keep giving, you won't have anything to give.
That's what they're saying, basically. There's even a more fundamental problem before you get off the ground.
How can something without limit give something?
Why is that a problem?
Because
part of everything.
It has everything. It is everything. There's no lacking. There's no lacking of what to give.
Nope.
What to give is not the problem. What is the problem?
No. I was going
to
say, where
there's nothing to give to if
right.
You're everything.
You
giving implies from me to
something else.
If you're everything there is, there's no one to give to. Hear this well. This is a problem. This cannot, according to the way we understand it at this moment, be a quality of this. And that's exactly what happens. Where we see from our scientific lens a Big Bang, the Kabbalists say that from the infinite's perspective, so to speak, it's called a tzimtzum. And a tzimtzum means a covering or a retraction. The infinite hides, as it were, some of its infiniteness, creates a lack where there was no lack in order to fill the lack. And what I just told you is the most important secret you'll ever hear in your entire life. I just told you, if you're listening, the purpose of every single particle in this universe, including ourselves, who are perhaps the most complex arrangement of particles. What is that purpose according to this model?
To fill a lack.
Almost. No, I didn't say we fill the lack. I said the infinite creates a lack to fill the lack. The infinite fills a lack. What is our purpose?
We are the lack.
Therefore, what's our purpose?
To return to the infinite.
To fill the lack.
Let me redirect your attention to this word that I was talking about a minute ago. This is the lack is the enactment of this. We had a problem. This couldn't happen because there was no... Why couldn't this happen before? There was no recipient, right? The creation of a lack is the creation of a recipient. And therefore, what is our purpose?
To receive.
To receive. To receive goodness. To receive pleasure. Believe it or not, that is what you were put on this planet to do. Whoa! I like this, Rabbi. Now, when I say that, let me qualify just a little bit, but not too much to scare you away. This is indeed what Abraham's great revolution was. Now, you've heard of Abraham, right? Y'all have said his name before. Abraham was famous as being the first what?
Jew.
First what?
Jew.
First Jew. What made him the first Jew? What did he realize that no one had realized before? What did he do that no one had done before? Sorry?
Circumcised
himself. That's a good answer. I don't know if he was the first one to do it, but he did it for a certain purpose. Right? Sorry?
He talked to God.
Was he the first one to talk to God in the Torah?
Oh, in the Torah.
No.
No.
He gave God the answer he wanted.
You know, I'm really glad I'm hearing you say what you're saying, because I'm glad no one says the first monotheist. That's the line I hear the most. That's actually a lie.
Yeah.
He definitely was not the first monotheist. He was, though, I'm going to give you a little bit of an insight of Abraham that will help you here. He lived in a polytheistic society where people really did actually bow down to stones. It's hard for us to imagine. People actually worshipped an inanimate object. It's hard to believe, isn't it? Like, would anybody today do that? You know, some piece of plastic or metal or stone that they would worship back then. And he said, this can't be. It can't be that the sun is the God we should bow down to. You know why? Because sometimes the sun gets covered up by a cloud or covered up by the moon even. And the moon is more powerful than the sun. Wait, the moon gets covered by clouds too. And Abraham realized that anything that's in the world that's finite must have a source. You know, the way the world works is things that exist come from something else. And he realized there must be something infinite that got it all started. That was not a revolution, by the way, entirely, because, you know, Aristotle did the same thing. A lot of people could do this. What Abraham did is he took it the next step. He said, wait a second. If what created this whole universe we live in was something infinite, by definition, it doesn't need anything, because it's infinite. So why did he create all this? Why would some infinite creator create all this? It doesn't need anything. It must not be for itself. It must be created for us. For us. To give to us. For our pleasure, said Abraham. And I want that pleasure, he said. And he figured out how to get it. And he taught it to his children. And it comes down to us in a system known as Judaism. You want to know what the definition of Judaism is? It's a system for teaching us how to maximize our ability to receive this divine flow of pleasure. This transcendent, infinite flow of pleasure. That's what it is. And I promised you before we go tonight, and we have just enough time, I was going to teach you a practical tool on how to actually start that process. Any comments or problems before we go there? Philosophical problems, emotional problems, spiritual problems, or directly with Rabbi Kahn. I'm here just for the intellectual problems. Yes?
Why would something that doesn't need anything create something that does in order to give it something?
As an expression of this.
But for what purpose?
For this purpose.
But
Because this is one of its qualities. It has all these qualities, and one of its qualities is giving. In order for that quality to be actualized, it has to have a recipient.
What about taking? Grace.
Sorry?
What about taking, then?
What about taking?
If it gives, isn't it take also? Mm-hmm.
Interesting question. Is taking a quality? I don't know how to think about it.
Well, how can you say giving is a quality? Opposite, you're saying good and bad are qualities, big and small are qualities.
Oh, I didn't say bad.
Well, I'm not saying, but if big and small are, you know, they're opposites, then why is taking an opposite?
Well,
the
answer to your question is there are some things that we can name all kinds of words up here. I can fill this list with infinite number of words, and that doesn't mean that they're all real qualities. Okay? Just like if I have a bunch of numbers, if I have a set of numbers, right? Make a proper set. Here's a set of number, real numbers. This actually isn't real. I mean, sense of the
idea.
Right? One, I can measure. Two, I can have two apples. Zero is nothing. It's just an idea. So the fact that I can write it down or I can label it doesn't make it real. So we have to analyze each of those terms separately and ask, well, is it real or not real? Okay, that's a very interesting, kind of more deep philosophical question. And the short answer is, Jewish philosophy says, this is a real quality, taking is not a real quality. Okay, now you're asking, well, what is taking? Okay, good question. This really requires further investigation. It's a very good question, yeah.
I don't mean to go off topic a little bit, but just wondering, how do we know then that this is real in that sense? A lot of people seem to have that question, how do we know life is real? How do we know that we are real?
And as opposed to what?
As opposed to, your theory, the idea, it's kind of hard to grasp because it's infinite, but how do we know that we're existing in this moment or, you know, did exist? What's the theory of time in that sense? Or
as opposed to that we don't exist?
Yeah.
Basically. And we're not having this conversation right now?
Yeah.
Well then, we're having it. Either we're not having it, so we'll stop talking, or we are having it.
It's true, okay.
Now.
Alan, are you talking about, like, the Matrix?
No, but, like, in philosophy, you generally ask, how do you know that, like, Descartes said, I think, therefore I am, and Catholics would say, I am, therefore I think.
Did you see the Matrix movie?
No, I saw the last one, actually.
Well, I heard the last one was bad. I didn't see it.
The second one was
the good. First one is the only one I saw. I think the first Matrix movie is an excellent analogy for the Jewish view of life. That life is at some level an illusion. At some level, there's something that's not ultimate about it. And that with proper philosophy, proper practice, one can actually transcend it. And that's exactly what the theme of the Matrix is. Although there's different details of the Matrix that aren't consistent. That's part of the movie to tell it, the storytelling. But I actually have a whole class I teach where I go through the Matrix and I show how it does correspond largely with the Jewish view of life, believe it or not. It happens to be made by two Jewish guys. I don't know what their educational background is. Sorry?
One of them's not a guy.
I'm not really sure how to parse that one. I hope that didn't get on the recording. Yeah. Someone had a question in the back? Yeah. Michael.
Because since Rabbi Kahn wants us to question everything that people present us now, and I don't mean to hassle you, but it's like, so I guess if you wanted to answer my question, you could say that the idea of taking could be signified within us. It's like that we're able to take what's been given to us. And that, I mean, saying, you know, if you're giving, there has to be a reciprocant, someone has to be, like, receiving it. So, I mean, I could say, well, then, is the infinite really giving to us, or taking it somewhere else and then putting it here?
You know, part of the problem, Mike, is we haven't defined taking. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure we're even on the same page with that. And it's really an interesting discussion, but we can't get into it right now. We're going to run out of time. I don't want to push it off. I just want to say we have to table it for now. Come back to it. It's a valid discussion, yeah. Ready for the practical exercise? Okay, the practical exercise is going to be how to do this, how to be a recipient, but working with the framework of the spirituality as we defined it, and working as a soul, using my body as opposed to my body using my soul. And for this exercise, I'm going to... I need to give you one other piece of information. If you're taking notes, great. If you're not, doesn't matter either. Why? Because it's in the book, which I think you're going to... Are we giving them a book or selling them a book? What are you going to do? Okay. You're going to get a book eventually. And this, what I'm about to tell you is in the book. The book looks like this. This is a Rorschach test. I hold this up to you and I say, what do you see? Right? See all the letters there? The first thing you see. Oh, you see the word of business. So you're very connected, see. I show this to a lot of women, the first thing they see is men. I see, show it to some people who have been, you know, on other parts of the country, they see Zen. Some people see amen, right? It actually says amazement, the art of amazement. And this is what we're talking about now is all in here. Everything, there's a lot more details. There's footnotes and there's other sources for further reading and so on. This whole wisdom and the practice is what I call the art of amazement. It's really Judaism, I believe. It's just one way of understanding Judaism. And what I'm going to show you now, just real quickly, is this. That's the most important part of the book. I know college students love charts and visual aids. What this is this is a map of your life. This tells you every experience you have in life and every goal you have and every dream you have, every pain, every pleasure, fits into this map. And understanding the map will help you understand why you have pain sometimes and why you have sometimes you don't feel so great and why sometimes you feel better. If you can understand this map, it'll show you how to fix everything. This is really the roadmap to your to becoming a spiritually enlightened person. A stands for aesthetic. What does aesthetic mean? Enjoying a beautiful sunset. Enjoying your favorite drink. You know, I say pleasure, most people think of being on the beach with their favorite drink in each hand. I agree, that's definitely can be a pleasurable thing.
Aesthetic. Like aestheticism?
Not aestheticism, like okay. Where you fast and put pins
right,
and needles
that's
into
what
your
I'm
skin.
Right, because it's like gossip.
Aesthetic, maybe is another pronunciation. Aesthetic. Aesthetics.
Okay.
Like art, music.
Okay, that makes sense.
Enjoying beauty in the world. Aesthetics. Physical beauty enjoyed is called spiritual pleasure. Just because it's physical doesn't make it, you can't, it's not spiritual, right? But there's a difference between enjoying and just consuming, right? We're going to learn about that. What's L? L is love. Relationships. E is topic of the Maimonides program this semester. Ethics. And C is the way expansion of E, which is creativity. But this is going to be where you spend most of your time with Rabbi Kahn. Today I'm giving the model, and I'm going to give you the A. A is you know, these are levels. These are expansive. The further out you go, the greater the pleasure. And most people look at that and think, wait a second. Isn't love the ultimate? How could E be outside of L? Well, it is, and you'll find out. What's the T?
Torah.
let's leave religion out of this for now, okay? Okay, here's your exercise. You're going to get from me a little bag here, and in the bag is a little treat. You heard about the orange crisis last week in California? These things are, each one of these bags costs $102.59. So you better, I'm just joking, wasn't that expensive? It's only $101. When you get a bag, here's your exercise. There's three pieces of orange in each bag, two small ones and one big one. Your job right now is to eat one small piece of orange. Do not eat the big piece till I tell you. Anybody does, terrible things will happen, okay? Want to pass it around, please?
Mine only has two pieces.
No, are you sure?
Yeah,
okay, it can't be.
You're pretty good, though.
It can't be.
Well, yeah, there's
here.
A whole bag behind me.
That's good as luck there.
No way.
Straight in.
Oh, right now.
What are we supposed to do?
Right now, we're supposed to eat the small
piece. Eat the small piece right now. No delay. Eat a small piece. Only one small piece. Okay, while you're eating your pieces of orange, I'm going to just tell you a little bit of orange humor. You know, now that the California oranges are in trouble this year, we're turning to Florida oranges, but Florida oranges are a problem because they're mainly used for juicing. Did you know that California and Florida orange industries, they make fun of each other? Florida oranges are really juicy for making orange juice, and California oranges are thicker skin made for eating. And here's what they say. In Florida, in California, they say, if you want to eat a Florida orange, you have to sit in the bathtub. In Florida, they say that you can run over a California orange with a steamroller and not even get the pavement wet. That's what they say. I read about that when I was researching oranges. Okay, did you eat your first piece of orange?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, now, let's get out our second piece of orange.
Big or small?
The small. Another small one. Yeah, big one has to wait. There are napkins here in case it gets a little messy. We'll pass those around too, please.
I can tell the difference between the oranges.
You can tell the difference?
Yeah, this...
We haven't eaten the second piece yet.
No, I mean, like, the Florida...
Oh, okay, these are California oranges, I think. Okay, your second piece of orange, this is going to be... that wasn't part of the program. Everybody hold up your second piece of orange, please. And are there extras around anywhere? Are there extra bags of oranges? Where's the big bag with the oranges? Raise your hand if you have it. Okay, anyone needs some extra pieces in the back?
Well, you're not supposed to eat it already. Right?
The second piece? Absolutely not. I didn't tell you to.
You'll be okay.
Hold up your second piece of orange, please. If you ate it already, shame on you. We have extra ones. Where are the extra ones?
Back here.
What happened? Back there? You guys are hogging them back there? Come on, let's pass them up. You're not allowed to eat your second piece of orange yet. This is going to be a lesson in orange appreciation.
Delayed gratification.
Please smell your second piece of orange. How's it smell?
Orange.
Orange is interesting.
Orange, give me a better word now. Citrusy. Give me a quality.
What?
Scale of 1 to 10. Is it a good smell?
Yeah.
Shh. Look at it carefully. See how it's made of these little cells? It's really cool how oranges are made. Actually, all fruit's made that way, but most fruit, the cells are too small to see. I have a question for you. Let's say an alien beamed down from outer space right now, and he ends up in the middle of the room here, and where he came from, they ran out of water on the ship, and he's really thirsty. He says, I'm so thirsty. You guys have anything to, and we hand him one of these, right? Is he going to know where to bite into? No? Look at it. Doesn't the inside look so much more juicy and inviting than the outside? Maybe it's just my conditioning. It is kind of remarkable that you have this thick skin that protects the fruit inside. If an orange falls off a tree, you can still eat it. It might get a little bruised, but not much. Anyone ever seen an orange tree? Actual orange tree? Yeah? Mm-hmm. What color is the fruit when it's on the tree?
Green.
Sorry? Did you say it's green? Is it always green? Does it stay green forever until it's picked?
No.
At what point does it change color?
That's right.
Isn't that amazing? It's color-coded. It blends in with the leaves, and then as soon as it's ripe, bing, pick me, right? What is it? Look at your orange. What is it obviously made out of mostly?
Water.
Beta-carotene.
Mostly water. Actually, I had a botany student in this class one time, and he said 92%. Now, I have a question for you. You all are a few years out of high school. Let's pretend... Go back in your mind to middle school, and I'm your middle school teacher, I'm your science teacher. I say, class, we have a class project. You know what we're going to do this year? We're going to make oranges. I give you a bucket of water, because you agree oranges are mostly made out of water, right? Here's your bucket of water. Go for it. What are you going to do? Now, no funny stuff here. How are you going to, as a class, for your science project, going to make oranges out of a bucket of water? What are you going to do?
Get dried oranges and inject them.
I don't know if you can be very successful that way.
Pour it over the ground that has some seeds in it already.
Right. That's a pretty good idea. Anything else you need besides ground and seeds and water?
Sunlight.
Little sunlight. Very good. Okay. Now, that's not how we usually water oranges, is it? No. How do we usually water oranges?
I have no idea. I don't know. There's irrigation systems.
Yeah. You all learned about the water cycle, didn't you, when you were in high school?
Rain.
Where does the rain come from? From the clouds. And how does it get to the clouds?
Evaporation.
What caused evaporation?
The sun.
Sun. Okay, the sun. Again, the sun comes back in the picture. It's very important. Now I start to understand why those Babylonians worshipped that sun. Right. Very, very important. Is the sun always been there though, or was Abraham right that it also had an origin? It had an origin, didn't it? What was the origin of the sun's energy? Where'd it come from?
Big Bang.
Big Bang, right? And we as Jews know where the Big Bang came from. From the infinite, the source of everything. Now what you have I just given you is a direct chain in your mind from this ultimate source to this orange in your hand. But wait, we're not done yet. One second. Take off your middle school hat. Put on your board of directors hat, okay? You are now, I've elevated you to the board of directors of the Ford Foundation, the biggest research funder in the world, okay? And I walk in to the board meeting, I say, ladies and gentlemen, I've decided what I want to fund this year. Let's fund the scientific production in a test tube of, bing, and I hold this up. How much do you think we're going to have to invest to get these? Forget the seeds, forget the water, the sunshine, let's make them in the laboratory. After all, look what happened in California last week, can't have that happen again. Let's find a way to make this in the laboratory. How much do you think we should have to invest this year to make it? A couple million? What'd you say?
A lot.
A lot. I'm not sure it can be done, but it certainly would be millions or billions of dollars of research funding. Do you realize how precious this ought to be, this piece of fruit in your hand? Now, it should be millions of dollars. I mean, it should be... What does it cost? What do these cost in the market today? How much per pound?
$120.
I'll ask you a more important question. How much did you pay for this class tonight?
Free.
What, you're getting free food? What did you do to deserve such goodness? I'm asking you. Think about it. Think about it. Smell it again. Now, one last thought. You know, this thing comes in the winter when they're full of vitamin C and other vitamins that we need. In this season, the flu season, it's a really incredible thing. Color-coded. And not only that, how about the fact that you have taste buds? Could you survive without taste buds?
Yes.
Absolutely. An amazing thing. We have hands to hold it with and eyes to see it with. Now this time, before you eat your second piece of orange, let's get into our meditative posture. Let's instantly get relaxed and into our alpha state with our eyes closed. And this time I want you to bite into your second piece of orange, and this time think about, before you bite into it, how wonderful it is, where it ultimately comes from, how it's such a gift, how you don't even deserve to be eating it. And go ahead, this time let it roll over your tongue and really chew it and taste it. Go ahead. In other words, Judaism says your mother was right. You should slow down and chew your food. Show of hands, if the second eating experience is better than the first. Most people say yes. Not everybody? No? Maybe?
No.
What Judaism is trying to tell you is, if you're really plugged into this wisdom and you want to do this, what you just did was, if you savor that piece of orange, if you savor it, you're being a spiritual person. If you also appreciate that it's a gift, then you're being a transcendental person. The T is transcendental. You're connecting this experience to its source. That's what Judaism is saying, that you should do that with every bite of food for the rest of your life. And not just every bite of food. You know, I have this interesting photograph here. See how receptive you are. What is unusual about this sunset?
obviously unusual about it? It's not really a trick question.
Shape?
What do you notice about the shape?
It's like a bulb.
It's like a light bulb shape, isn't it?
Yeah.
The reason this seems so unusual to you, this is actually a sunset no one's ever seen before. This photograph was taken on Mars.
Hmm.
Now my question for you is, why do you go, to that, but not to the birds chirping outside? Or not to the air that you breathe, or everything else that's wonderful in our lives? Why does it take something like this to make you go,
You've never experienced it before.
Because you're not used to it.
You
take everything else for granted, exactly. And the whole purpose of having this kind of wisdom is to make sure that you don't take things for granted. That you start to savor and appreciate and connect and transcend with every experience. That's just on the aesthetic. We haven't talked about relationships or ethics yet. We're just talking about the aesthetic, the physical. This is how you do it with the physical right now. Everything else comes later. Any problems with that? Are you ready to go out and start appreciating? Start being amazed? Yeah?
What about the things, the crappy things in life?
The crappy things in life. That's a really good question. That's a really good question. I appreciate the directness with which you asked it. For example, slipping and falling on the ground. Believe it or not, once you get good at this map, once you go through this program, I don't know if this semester will be enough, you start to be able to do the same thing with everything. With everything. And I think ethics is going to come on to, I don't know if you'll get into it this semester or not, Rabbi Kahn will have to tell you, but all those things get dealt with, yes. Even the crappy things.
It's kind of like, I never get mad at myself when I hit a bad shot in golf, because it's like, no, I'm serious, it's like, you have to just think like, you hit that shot, you're never going to hit it again, so why worry about the bad shot, you know?
You know, that's a very great optimistic outlook. I prefer to frame it like Nietzsche did. You ever, anyone study Nietzsche? Nietzsche has a famous quote. He said, "Anything that doesn't kill me only makes me stronger." Everything that's painful actually has a silver lining, so to speak. Every cloud has a silver lining. Well,
Nietzsche didn't believe in God, though.
Therefore,
it's just interesting that.
Not believe in God, he just said God is dead.
Yeah.
People always, whenever I teach a class, someone has to bring up God for some reason. Like, why does God always have to drag in the picture? No matter how much I try to avoid the subject, they always drag in God in the discussion. You know, this is an interesting topic. I'm going to just show you something about the word God. You know, I'm not sure I believe in God either. When I first came back to America from Israel where I was studying, I was in Silicon Valley, California. I was sitting with a prominent venture capitalist, Jewish guy, yeah? And he had gone through a Jewish education when he was a kid. And he said, "Rabbi, I don't know what we have to talk about. See, I don't believe in God." I said, "That's okay, I don't either." He looked at me like I was nuts. I said, "I'm sure whatever you mean when you say God, I don't believe in that either. I'm sure whatever Nietzsche meant when he said God, I don't believe in that either. The problem is I think that the greatest stumbling block to Jewish spirituality in all of history, listen to this, was a guy named Michelangelo. You know what I'm talking about?
Sure.
You ever seen the picture of the Sistine Chapel? There's an old man, that's God, about to touch the finger of the Adam. You know that picture, the famous picture? Michelangelo, in the 16th century, gave us quite literally a cartoon image of God. Think about it. That's what it is. That was the 16th century equivalent of a cartoon. And it's permeated our culture so much. I see this in the newspaper all the time. I saved one just to show you. The caption says, "I'm sorry, God, but I'm afraid this has so many problems that it's beyond repair. I suggest you toss it and create a new one." Right? There's our image of God that a lot of people, when they think the word God, that's what they see. Now, that may not be what you meant, but I always, you know, in terms of defining our terms, if that's what you mean by God, if that you have any inkling of that image, then I'm not on the same page with you. By the way, I figured out why he painted the old man. Did I tell you this, Rabbi Kahn? I finally, after teaching this for years, I finally figured out why Michelangelo chose the old man with a white beard. You know why?
Wisdom.
No. Because they believe that one guy is his son, right? So if JC is his son, so dad's going to have to look like an old version of JC, right? Just with a beard that's white and the robes. No? Does that make sense? I think that's an insight. I can sell that idea. Should get me on Oprah. Okay. we have to wrap here, and to wrap, I haven't given you the final, we have to eat the final piece of orange, I haven't given you the final piece of wisdom. This is really crucial, important, I'm running out of time. As a wrap, how do you do this? Because life is busy. I don't have time, Rabbi, to go appreciating everything all the time, especially the birds and the air and the everything, the trees. I'm running around trying to get my grades and my job and everything else. So we have this meditation. The rabbis gave us this meditation in order to actually eat that third piece of orange properly. If you use this meditation, it's a tool. This is the practical tool I was going to give you. This meditation is called the source meditation. Why is it called the source meditation? Because the whole idea is to relate this experience back to its source. And here's how it looks. You, the infinite, are the source. Now that should be enough. I should be able to say, okay, you, the infinite, are the source. I don't need it, but there's a problem there. First of all, why is it in the you? You is not personifying. You is not saying if it's a person. But what draws me closer to somebody? If I talk about her or if I talk to you? If you see how that draws me into you by using the second person? That's why it's in the second person, for drawing you in. The infinite, of course, is beyond all space and time, are the source. But that's not enough, because didn't we just say a few minutes ago this is about me and my pleasure? What's all this talk about the infinite? What about me? Where do I fit in this picture? What's my relationship to the infinite? This answers someone's question. I think it was Mike's, or I forget who asked this question before, and I don't remember how you phrased the question, but the question is this. I'll rephrase it the way I remember it. Does the infinite continue to be infinite after the creation of the finite? Didn't someone ask that question? Everyone touch your chair. Finite or infinite?
Finite.
I agree. Bona fide, 100% finite, right? So there's a spot where there's no infinite, right?
But the essence is...
Amazing. Is your chair finite or infinite?
Finite.
So there's a spot where there's no infinite, right?
No.
You disagree with me that it's finite, and not infinite.
100%. Wait, I believe it is infinite.
I'm telling you, it's a paradox. How do finite and infinite coexist? That's a paradox, right? In fact, if you think about it, like the Matrix film, they have to coexist. In fact, where we see a big bang, boom, right? That's our scientific view. From the infant's perspective, how old is the universe? Our view is maybe 5,000 years, maybe 5 billion years, I don't know. How old is the universe from the infant's perspective? When was it created? Beyond all space and time.
You can't act with.
Exactly. It's a meaningless statement. In other words, right now, and right now, and right now, every moment. It continues to have to make it every moment. And that's what this word means. Our power in nature means, like the generator making nature happen all the time. If the infinite stops making it happen, according to Jewish philosophy, nature stops existing. And the second idea is director of the hidden, meaning this tells me about how I relate to the infinite, and this tells me how the infinite relates to me. If you're sensitive to this idea, you'll appreciate the infinite's like the puppet master pulling the strings. Okay? Infinite to the orange, me to the infinite, infinite to me. Last step. What about the relationship of the infinite of the orange to the infinite? How does the orange, what is the relationship? We understand that the infinite's the source of the orange. How does the orange relate back to the infinite? So the answer is that it made the orange, right? What tense? What tense?
Past.
Present. Creating fruit. Now here's the punchline. This meditation, I taught it to you in English on purpose first. When I showed it to you in Hebrew, some of you are going to say, wait a second, I've heard of that before. But it's not the way you understood it. This, in Hebrew, a source in Hebrew is the actual word for source or spring is a brecha. And this type of meditation is called a bracha. You heard that before? But if you think it's a blessing, then I got to fix your head. You know what a blessing is? It's That's where I say you should live long, have many children, right? That's a blessing. Now we're not doing that to make a bracha, right? Remember the difference between the first piece of orange and the second piece? That should be the same idea in your mind now, the difference between the way you used to think of a bracha and the way we understand it now. A bracha is not a blessing, it is a spiritual opportunity to have this transcendental moment with this piece of fruit. How does it come out in Hebrew? What's you in Hebrew?
Atah.
Are the source is Baruch. We flip it around. Baruch Atah means you are the source. That's what it means. Infinite is this four-letter word. These, by the way, are not Hebrew letters, but we treat this word with such respect, understanding what it represents. We don't even like to erase it. So I like draw lines between the letters. This word is pronounced Adonai. And what do you think of when you say it? God. The infinite. What did you say?
God.
We have another hour here. The infinite, beyond all space and time. If you don't think of that while you're saying a bracha, you're saying it wrong. R-O-N-G, wrong. Okay? So it's Baruch Atah. Baruch Atah Adonai. Can you guess what our power in nature is? Eloheinu. By the way, Elohim are little gods. Elohim Acherim, other gods. Little statues that they used to worship and they still do in some countries. Little powers. Things that people would, if you want to have the rainfall, you go to the rain god and push the right buttons. You want to have a good harvest, you go to the good harvest god and push the buttons. Things that you, if you just push the right buttons, you'll get what you want. That's what a god is. What are modern versions of this?
Saints.
How about for non-religious people? Pushing the right buttons to get what you want. Technology, money, right? If I just get the right technology, everything will solve all my problems. That's a modern god. A Jewish God with a small g, that's the infinite. That's our real power. Director of the hidden is Melech Ha'olam. Oh, I thought a Melech was a king, right? Well, a king is a guy with a crown on his head. What does a king do? What did you say?
Rules.
What does that mean?
Oversees, controls,
direct. Would this be that accurate, you think?
Direct.
He doesn't physically control, he tells other people what to do, right? Finally, creating fruit in the present tense. Bore pri ha'etz. Now, listen. Some people are thinking, oh, this is a tricky way to teach me to make a blessing. It's not actually. It's actually a tremendously powerful spiritual thing. I've taught this to unconnected Jews. I've taught it to Orthodox Jews. I've taught it to Hasidic Jews. And every time I teach it, people say, wow, that's, I never realized that it had so much power. To really get it, though, you have to try it. It's experiential. The great thing about a bracha is it's a way of being spiritual and nobody knows it, because you can go like this, you know? You know? You can be like, you know, you can be in the lunchroom, and no one has to know you're being spiritual at that time, right? You can just make a little bracha, and you probably about it. And we actually have, to prove to you this is so important, do you know there's a different bracha for fruit than for vegetables? Did you know that? And there's a different one for wine, Brei Pri Hagafen, one for bread. Do you know that there's three different brachas for different kinds of smells? There's a special bracha when you hear unusually good news. And a different bracha for when you hear unusually bad news. It comes from the same source. There's a special bracha for a parent holding their newborn baby. There's a special bracha when you see an unusually beautiful person or animal. Whoa. And a different one for unusually ugly. They used to say it on elephants. Before zoos were common. Right? There's a special bracha to say after you go to the bathroom. It's like, hey, I can hold it in, I can let it out. It's amazing, right? Instead of living like an animal, elevate the moment. Take it back to its source. Appreciate what you have and how it's a gift. What a real gift. Anyone who's ever had true physical problems or sickness knows what a gift health is, and have a healthy working body. And gosh, what an opportunity to appreciate that every, you know, a few times a day. So much so the Talmud suggests that you make 100 brachas a day. Now think about it for a second. If you take an 16-hour day and divide by 100, how often are you making a bracha on average? Any math majors? Math students! Every 10 minutes, on average, you're going to pause and have this meditative moment. Okay, you can, not necessarily that you have to do it that way, but what an opportunity. The Talmud is saying, we have hundreds of brachas that you can access if you want to. But that's not the point. The point is not to become a religious person making brachas. What's the point? Remember the chart I had before? The point is to walk around with this connection so that you're not living on automatic pilot anymore, but you're having that wow of that sunset whenever you want to. Okay, ready for the bracha? Let's try it. Meditative posture. Here we go. Smell the orange. Appreciate it. Look how beautiful it is. Now, we're going to make the bracha. By the way, what language, obviously, should you make it in?
Hebrew.
I'm not getting through to you people. It's not magic words here. This is a meditation. If you don't understand the Hebrew, what's the point? Any language you understand, Hebrew, Chinese, whatever. If you can have it like this where you can read the Hebrew and see the English, great, if you understand it. But don't mouth empty words. That's not Jewish practice, just to say words you don't understand. I don't believe in it. I don't advocate it. I know Rabbi Kahn does it. Don't do it. It's a waste of your time. Okay? This is supposed to be a spiritual experience. Okay? You look up the board if you want to. I'm going to say it out loud in Hebrew. You want to say it in any language you want, fine. But the main point is to appreciate it and to close your eyes after you say the bracha and to really chew it slowly like we did before, but this time relate it back to the source. Here we go. Ready? Rabbi Kahn, do you have one? You gotta give him where's the bag of oranges?
Oh, Rabbi Kahn.
Okay. Smell your orange. Meditative posture. Ah, oh, beautiful. It's full of vitamin C and I have eyes to see it with and taste buds and it's so juicy. Here we go. Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Ha'olam Borei Peri Ha'etz. I've taken you over time and I apologize. I really meant to end by 9. My challenge for you, first of all, did we meet the goals? Number one, I said we were going to give you a definition of spirituality. Did we meet that goal? Yes?
Yeah.
Number two, I said I'm going to teach you the purpose of life. Did we meet that goal?
Yes.
Yeah.
Number three, I said we're going to give you practical tools you can apply 1 to 2. Did we do that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My challenge for you is this. Try this. Take one bracha. I don't care which one. This one, the one on a glass of water, coffee, whatever. Try saying it once a day for a week. But not just saying it, like the whole thing, the concentration, appreciation. Just try it once a day and see how it affects your life. I hope that you have a great semester and that you all get straight A's and achieve all your dreams in school and beyond. And I hope to see you again. Thank you for having me.
You know, that is...